This is GamesAtWork.biz with your hosts, Michael Martin and Michael Rowe. This is episode 17, Things Are Weirder Than Expected. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Michael Rowe here. Another exciting episode of GamesAtWork.biz with my co-host, Michael Martin, who is halfway around the world. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, Michael. It's great to be here with you. It's certainly afternoon for me, but it's morning and evening and elsewhere for other people in the world.
That's how it works.
I'm coming to you live now from Budapest, Hungary, and I'm very, very happy to be here.
Great. And we have a very special guest this week. We're really excited.
Super special.
To introduce Ian Bogost. And I hope I didn't butcher your last name.
No, you got it. That's
excellent.
Great.
Well, Ian, welcome to the show.
So of Persuasive Games and other fame, we're really delighted to have you here with us today for this recording. And Michael, if you don't mind, I'll just kind of jump right in.
Let's do it.
Thought a little bit about a couple of questions that might be fun to ask you, you know, having you here on air with us. And in no particular order, I'll throw a couple of these out to just start us a seed conversation, and we'll probably go in six different directions from there. So the first is, will games ever get to the point, in your opinion, Ian, that they can fundamentally change people's worldview? Do you think that that's a possibility?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I guess one way to answer it would be to say no, but not for the reasons that you think, right? That we maybe nothing changes people's worldview, or maybe it doesn't do so in the simple way that we think it does. In other words, you know, we are constantly surrounded by all sorts of influences, people, media, all the stuff that we use to kind of make sense of our world. And to expect that that there are these sort of, you know, flows of history in which, you know, one medium is sort of dominant and really, you know, capturing all of our attention, and, you know, another, like those eras are perhaps over now. And, you know, now what we have is kind of mush of different stuff. And, you know, maybe instead of asking if people can change their worldviews, change their minds, change their perspectives through games, we should ask, well, okay, you know, let's take it as a given that that all sorts of things are influencing us. Games are one of them. They do so in a different way than books or television do. How do we make sense of that? How do we harness it? What uses are best for it, either as creators or as players? And, you know, that kind of answer, I think, is a more modest, maybe even more realistic take on the question than the kind of standard answer that we hear, which is usually either, you know, games are really bad and no one should be exposed to them ever, or games are the greatest thing and they're going to change everything about the way that we work and play and live. And I don't think either of those answers are adequate. So I kind of, you know, I wonder if there's this you know, this path in between them that we can find.
Yeah, that's great. I was actually thinking you were going to immediately go to the standard. The answer is, what do you mean? It already has, right?
So there's also stock answers to this question that those of us who work on games, you know, outside of entertainment tend to use. And, oh, you know, it's already happening. Let me give you three examples. Or, you know, the potential of games is great, but we haven't yet realized them. You know, and those kinds of answers are a little bit boring to me now. And I think maybe it's time for a little humility for us to say, you know, there's been good evidence that games actually haven't been successful at becoming a kind of mass medium in the way that those of us advocating for them have claimed that they would do, you know, the medium of the 21st century, et cetera, et cetera. And what do we make of that? And I think one thing we have to realize is that the world is different now than it was in 1890 or 1950 or 1980. And we have to adjust our expectations of exactly how media influence us. And one of those ways is by being kind of lost in a sea of other media.
So you know, that's an interesting thought, and it kind of harkens back to what you've written about in your latest book here, How to Do Things with Video Games. And where I'm going with this is, if you think about the traditional adoption, you know, curves, we've all seen the chart that says, you know, the telephone adoption was such and such, and radio adoption, you know, television and internet kind of go up and up at the scale. from what you're just saying, if you were to plot video games and gaming and sort of in that same space, would we say that it's a flatter curve? It's a slower adoption going up? I'm not sure that we would, because there's so many people who play casual games and the like. But what do you think about how that maps into games are not going to save the world, but they're also widely used by many, many, many people.
One of the arguments I make in the merely the main argument in the How to Do Things with Video Games book is that, you know, we can't necessarily look at the number of people using a medium as evidence for its maturity. Instead, we should look at the variety of uses to which a medium is put. So, you know, if you think about writing or photography or the moving image, or, you know, these media that we consider mature, yeah, a lot of people use them. Everybody reads something, and everybody watches television or films and so forth. Everybody sees and produces images. But that's not really the whole story. It's not the quantity of people that's the most important factor. It's the variety of uses to which those other media are being put. And, you know, if you walk into a bookstore, well, if maybe that's not the best example anymore, but if you browse books online, you see all sorts of different kinds of stuff, right? There's, you know, kind of trashy romance novels, and there's how-to books, there's help books, and there's books on cooking and all the different things that we can kind of think of doing, we have an inroad in to doing them with writing. And if you turn on your television, you've got a million different channels, all of which have specialized into kind of different purposes. And we don't distinguish anymore. We don't think about the fact that you press a button on your remote and you move from, you know, a Breaking Bad or The Wire on one channel to, you know, like a home and garden show or a cooking show on another. And even though those two things do very different have served very different purposes, we don't hesitate to think of them as they're both television. That's easy. Whereas with games, we don't have or we don't recognize that variety of uses. And I think there are several reasons for it. One of them is that there aren't as many explored purposes in games as there are in other media, but there are still a lot of different ways that people have and are using games, in which case those uses are not as visible to the general public. And without that visibility, and without that experience of, you know, playing a game to do your job training or to consume some crappy marketing message or to do all those kind of life, then they get under our skin less and less. So what we end up with are a lot of people playing, you know, kind of the equivalent of tentpole Hollywood blockbuster films in game form, and not a lot of people, you know, participating in all the other ways that they participate with anything they participate with in their lives via games. So the gap to close, in my mind, is not necessarily that of playership, that of audience and demographic, but that of purpose.
So you actually mentioned something kind of interesting as in this example that really got me thinking about your latest writing on the alien phenomenology, or what it's like to be a thing, which I know is different than the book that Michael was referencing. And one of the things you talked about in that book is around authenticity and how that brings people into things like The Wire, right, or Breaking Bad, et cetera. And I was wondering, was there a kind of a correlation in serious gaming and uptake as it relates to authenticity, or are serious games more successful if they don't go for that deep authenticity and go for things like more of the casual, fun, goofy gaming mechanics that engage people around fun and entertainment, but actually have that serious aspect or that learning aspect?
Yeah, there's all sorts of problems with serious games, and we could talk about them for a long time, I'm sure. But I think you've touched on one of them, which is that, I mean, in short, serious games tend to take themselves too seriously, which is an interesting irony, really, because the whole reason to bring games into, you know, the enterprise or government or wherever was supposedly to take advantage of some of these features of games. And yeah, I think that, you know, games' ability to model complexity that's a feature we don't get from other media as well. But games' ability to, maybe to trivialize things, you know, to use an example that is usually levied against games as a criticism, maybe that's actually a strength, that games trivialize things, they abstract things, they draw our attention to bits and pieces of them, and that's part of what we enjoy. They kind of focus us down on specific aspects of something, or they can when they're working well. But when you look at the serious games world, because of all sorts of essentially organizational political factors, no one in an organization is willing to let anything be left by the roadside, right? No, we have to get this in and this in, and we have to have my part represented, and this organization is concerned, and the learning people, you know, want to put their two cents in, and the design people want to fight back against it. Whereas really what games are the most powerful, perhaps, when they are treating something kind of surgically, you know, that they're pulling some aspect out of the world and this weird thing, and it's strange, and that may be one of the experiences that make ordinary games, you know, of entertainment, or even the kind that we don't think much about, so interesting. You know, so if you take a game like Angry Birds, which is no longer possible to ignore, even if we might like it, is it about that game? And you know, there's nothing new in it really. It's just a kind of little physics puzzle. And the birds are cute, and the pigs are cute, and that's part of it, I think. But you know, just this experience of kind of, you know, playing with physical behavior and the consequences of you know, very simple physics simulation, that hadn't been accessible to a wide audience before. It had been in lots of, you know, sort of curious, esoteric independent games, or even some big commercial games, but it hadn't been out there in public. And I think that is part of what makes that piece of media so interesting to people, is just, hey, let's just kind of play with this little physics simulation. Now, there's no reason we can't play with anything, really, but in order to do so, yeah, I think it has to be an authentic treatment of it. It has to be earnest. In one of my earlier books, Persuasive Games, I make this kind of quip, which I think people took as a joke, but I really meant it seriously, that, you know, if you want to use the word serious games, then the way to understand this term serious is in a kind of casual way, like you might talk about, you know, a serious dessert, like that's a serious cheesecake there that you brought home. You know, you mean like, oh, this is the real deal. Like, you've really gotten to the bottom of cheesecakiness with this cheesecake.
The essence of cheese.
represented. And that's what we're doing when we do game design best, is we're kind of pulling the essence out of something and drawing attention to it. And that essence isn't its appearance anymore, but it's behavior, which is what games are so good at portraying when they're made well.
Yeah, there was a game that came out of the UK, I believe it was last summer, maybe a little bit before that, on sexually transmitted diseases, which I thought was a really good example of you know, education, but really fun, almost silly goofiness, casual gaming mechanics. And I've got to try to find the name, and I'll put it in the show notes when I do, because I actually have it upstairs on my machine.
I don't remember the name either, but I know the game that you're referring to. I mean, I think there's another feature here, which maybe is not limited to gaming at all, and that's the use of humor and of irreverence and of parody and commentary in media. And it's, you know, certainly something that we've noticed in other media too. The Daily Show is the standard example, The Onion, which some people look at as being more serious news channels than the quote unquote real news, right? Because, you know, yes, they're kind of, you know, digging through all the BS and presenting a real perspective on the issues, whereas all the rest of television or print news is kind of a facade, you know, that's simply trying to maintain its appearance. So the power of humor and of kind of self-mockery too, of presenting a subject as being, again, you know, simplified, trivialized, you know, but in a good way. That's something that we've always seen in good, serious commentary, whether it's in essays or in cartoons or other forms that have preceded games.
Yeah, there's a really good book I read last summer from Cronkite to Colbert, which was really that
analysis of the shift of news media and how, exactly as you say, Ian, that the parody, the comedy of, you know, shows like Colbert and Jon Stewart actually provide a much more serious review of the news situation than what many people are seeing in traditional news media.
Well, it's getting people to pay attention to it in a different way, wouldn't you say? I mean, there's a similar genre in literature, if you want to even call it a genre right now, of the zombification of various books. You know, the one that springs to mind for me immediately is Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. So, you know, granted, I can imagine that most young male readers are not going to pick up Pride and Prejudice and go, ooh, Jane Austen, let's read all about that. But if it has zombies on it, they might.
Yeah, it certainly seems more likely that Pride and Prejudice with zombies, you know, has a readership in today's media ecosystem than Pride and Prejudice without zombies.
So I, you know, on the same point, you wrote some interesting elements about pranking that Michael and I have enjoyed over the years too. I'm remembering your birthday, Michael, where I put all the monitors in your office. Then you were really ticked off about that, as I remember. Maybe I shouldn't have remembered that. So here's an interesting kind of switch on that, on the pranking topic, because I think the making fun of news or serious topics, whether you're looking at a game form like Disaffected or looking at the TSA game or a variety of other ones like that, the question I wanted to ask you, Ian, is when does pranking become griefing in your mind?
Yeah, right. I mean, I suppose that the difference between pranking and griefing fundamentally is that griefing is really meant to injure. You know, it's meant to disturb people beyond that level of realization, of self-realization or recognition of seeing something they hadn't seen before, and to move into the domain of you know, true merciless hurtfulness. And sometimes it's anonymous, or sometimes it's generally directed, right, rather than at a specific individual. But I think that, you know, there's a fine line often between pranking and griefing, even in just office pranks or whatever. And it's different for everybody. And you have to know, you know, who's gonna perceive my prank as a kind of personal attack, you know, kind of griefing, rather than as a way of digging under your daily behavior or your weird habits or whatever it is that you choose to, you know, to embody in a prank. But I think it's that, you know, it's not just a matter of intention. In other words, it also has to do with how things are received. But fundamentally, I think, you know, the difference is, you know, are you successful in getting that pause from, you know, a player or the recipient of a prank, where they say, oh, you know, I've seen something, you know, something fundamental about the situation that was presented was revealed to me, whether that is, you know, here's the absurdity of the TSA, or, you know, here's the kind of weird self-loathing of workers at a copy store, or here's the absurdity of, you know, day-to-day life in the white-collar office world. You know, that's still the level of commentary of insightful ranking. Whereas if the main reaction is just dishonor or hurt or pain, then you can't really pay attention to those observations anymore, and so the prank will have failed. It won't have drawn out that kind of critical observation that it might have done otherwise.
And really, the medium of the game is no real different than any other medium. It's the intent behind it and the way that it's understood by the user, I guess, in this case.
I mean, I think we can make a sort of general, you know, commentary about certain kinds of horizontal, you know, purposes to which different kinds of media are put, whether that's pranking or exercise or work or play, for that matter, you know, entertainment. And that is that we have a certain predisposition to what they mean, what they're supposed to do. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they work. I think exercise is a good example of this. All of the different ways in which we have, over, let's say, the last 30 years, tried to get ourselves to be physically active, you know, have largely been failures. You know, the exercise video was no more successful than the exercise game really has been. And yeah, it works for some people, just like everything works for some people. You know, so part of what we're doing when we make games that do something specific, again, you know, whether that's pranking or advertising or entertainment or exercise or whatever, is we're kind of participating in a history of different media that have tried to do the same kinds of things. And you know, I suppose the optimist would say that we're constantly improving the methods by which we carry out certain goals. And the realist might say, you know, we're often kind of circling around the same drain in different ways. And, you know, neither one of those perspectives is tragic or worth celebrating to me. It's just that, you know, we kind of as human beings struggle forward toward self-realization, and it happens and starts.
Yeah, the way I kind of think about it too, Ian, is this is almost a sort of an attention as a currency. So the pranking games or games involve a degree of pranking. There's some out there around fitness where you can kind of nudge one another or be watching one another and goading one another on a little bit. But I've the games that I've really enjoyed playing are where there's these subtle little digs that you get to do in the game that just kind of bring you back for more and more. The one I'm thinking about in particular, it's a rather old one. It was played on the Apple II, and it was Mario Brothers. And we used to play Killer Mario Brothers. So instead of being cooperative, you'd run around and you'd hit the POW button at just the right time when the guy was about to kick a turtle off, and he'd bite him, and that would be the end of that. And you just kind of laugh about it and, continue moving on. And there are other games I've played since then that have a little bit of that, okay, Schadenfreude, you know, can I get the other player just a little bit? Not so much that it's hurtful, but it's kind of fun, and it keeps you coming back for more.
Game kind of get you. I mean, this is a very simple.
If I'm, it's true. And ones that kind of keep me playing too, like Michael and I are playing Draw Something with one another. And it's been my turn now for a while since I've had trouble getting on Wi-Fi to do my turn for the Draw Something. But that's kind of a social reciprocity and an attention currency mechanism as well to say, all right, you know, we're staying a little closer because I'm sending him a drawing. You know, used to be once a day, and now it's been a little bit longer. So, Michael, I'm sorry, but they'll come again soon.
To be honest, I haven't had time to even load the app. Yeah, so I thought it was my turn.
but it nags you and it goads you on. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're dead on about what Draw Something really, really is, or at least what it used to be. I think almost everybody has had the drop-off in play that you're describing. And that was just this kind of like throwing a ball back and forth. You know, it's like, here I am, and here you are, and I'm still here, and you're still there. And isn't that nice? And we're sort of having a weird conversation via these bad drawings that we can do only to the level we can do them because that's the way the app works. And it's really just like, you know, kind of tossing a ball back and forth or having an idle conversation or doing something that doesn't really matter, but that also matters by virtue of the fact that it doesn't really matter. And so you can kind of commit to it. And the knowledge that you're spending the time with someone else is enough. It's a very weird sort of experience because it has nothing to do with scoring points or even with drawing pictures, really. It's just that you have to do something. You might as well draw.
So Ian, I have to ask this question about CalClicker because it's out there, but, you know, and it's been a while ago. The question I have for you is the lessons that you've learned from CalClicker, from where you stand today, right now, where do you think that's pointing us for the direction of future games and the future of gaming itself?
Right. I mean, I think a lot about CalClicker because I spent much more time than I thought I meant to working on it, whatever that means. And I'd like to take something meaningful away from it. And I guess the thing I learned the most from CalClicker is that things are weirder than we expect. They surprise us. And so, you know, what it would mean for that game to have succeeded, I don't even know what that means anymore. It used to mean, you know, well, here's a kind of, you know, critical observation about social games. And if you sort of internalize that and reflect on it, that would be enough. But then CalClicker players ended up doing much, much stranger things than I ever expected. And, you know, the observation, the correct and true observation that people like clicking on pictures of cute cows I've had a hard time kind of, you know, coming to terms with that, because it's in some ways exactly the opposite of all the arguments I've been making about games for years now, which is, you know, the games are all about sort of complexity and interaction and dealing with the moving parts of a system. But then it also turns out that games are about clicking on a cute cow. And, you know, what do we do with that observation? How do you kind of take that lesson in a new direction? And I think, you know, one direction to take it in is the one I was alluding to earlier, which is that we don't need to have a single outcome for games. In fact, we want not to have a single outcome for games. What we want is a kind of, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom situation in which all of the various forms of games get realized, not just so that they can all exist equally and be equally worthy of praise, but rather so that we can start making decisions about which kinds of games work well and work poorly for different purposes. We need a lot more stuff on the table, in other words. And I think that's kind of the era that we're in now with gaming. It's just putting a bunch of stuff on the table, or throwing against the wall, if you prefer that metaphor, seeing what sticks and why, and then moving forward in more surgical ways, you know, making games for more specific purposes and realizing that they are specific purposes. They're not just, you know, kind of pieces of general entertainment that that people are doing instead of you know, going to the movies or watching television or reading books. And, you know, the way I would summarize that is that, you know, we're in kind of the media era of games. Turning games into a legitimate medium means seeing them thrive in a lot of different contexts and situations. And so, you know, Cow Clicker, the way that Cow Clicker serves that lesson is by demonstrating that the thing that was a parody to me was also a bunch of other things to other people. And we're both right.
Well, Ian, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been really, really fun and exciting. And while we aren't having the Cowpocalypse right now, we do want to have people know where they can follow you or reach you, see the kind of cool work that you're doing and some of the thoughts that you're having around gaming. Are there specific sites or Twitter, sure, or anything else?
The easiest thing is to check out my website, which is my last name, bogost.com, bogost.com. And on Twitter, I'm iBogost, and I'll look forward to seeing all of your listeners there, and they can mock and prod at me online.
Excellent. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, thank you, Ian. This has been great.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and you can follow us at Twitter at GamesAtWork_BIZ. We'd like to thank the guys at Zebes Systems for their rocking version of the Moon Patrol game theme.